yesterday we had the recitation of the Mangala Sutra in Pali and also the Heart Sutra in Chinese. And is there a recitation of Heart Sutra in English?
Tomorrow. Okay.
No. Okay, again, another.
Tomorrow.
So Indonesian Heart Sutra in Indonesian will be recited tomorrow.
The Pali tradition.
That Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Sri Lanka, and these countries, the Pali tradition kept 1,000 years, kept very well, and particularly Vinaya practice, they kept very well. Then Sanskrit tradition, China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, mainly is this area, and then Mongolia and Tibet, this area over 1,000 years is kept. Although different area, sometimes some difficulties, but basically the local culture very much related with Buddha Dharma. So naturally, the people from these countries, the Buddhism, they consider part of their culture, like that. So now I always say telling, now we should be 21st century Buddhist. So we must learn, we must study. So traditionally, non-Buddhist countries, now, you see, people who loves reasons, and you see, want to investigate with some skepticism. So a Buddhist way of approach, see, brings some attraction, brings worry, creates some attraction. So including many scientists. They basically, they are quite skeptical about faith. But when they investigate about the Buddhist way of approach, like famous scientist Einstein, one time you see he also expressed Buddhist way of approach is something quite sort of close with scientific way of approach or way of thinking. That's true. So in any way, so that's why the previous, His Holiness Pope, the German Pope, he emphasizes faith and reason must go together. So he also, you see, emphasizes reasons are important. Just recently I met some Muslim friend, some Arab area. So we just, you see, casual talk and about the harmony among different religious traditions. We discuss about that. Then one then, as usual, it's a question and answer. And then one person asked me, modern science sometimes creates some problem about religious faith. And I told him, if we think more deeper way, no problem. Modern science is mainly focusing the matters which we can measure and also to calculate. And also we can also rely on third person, the observer, one, a third person, like that. So all religions, their main sort of, the point focus is not matter, but mind, emotion. So all major religious tradition, see, now I think basically theistic religion, non-theistic religion, all theistic religion, you see, they emphasize God as a creator, whole world created by God. So, what is the purpose? What is the purpose of, you see, that single-pointed faith? I feel, you see, two things. Once you have single-pointed faith towards God, in order to increase, in order to strengthening that single-pointed faith, you see, the concept of creator come. God created all world, ourselves, we each individual, we also created by God. So that strengthening, single-pointed faith towards God, so that automatically reduce self-centered attitude, isn't it? You, as I say, may be a very, very powerful person, but still, ultimately, God's sort of the creature. So, you must sort of obey God as our Father. So that automatically reduce self-centered attitude. They reduce self-centered arrogance. I. Now, meantime, God always described infinite love. God, tremendous love towards his own creations, right? So the more sort of the closeness feeling with Creator, there's more willingness to follow God's sort of, what's the guides. That's practice of love, compassion. And all religion, you see, sort of Kasoda realize there is strong opposition about practice of love. So all religion is to teach practice of tolerance, practice of forgiveness, and the practice of contentment, practice of self-discipline. These all major religions, you see, talking all these things. So that clearly shows all major religious tradition, you see, really carry message of love. One my Muslim friend, once he told me, in public, he told me, a genuine Islam practitioner must extend loves towards entire God's, Allah's creature. So it's a different way of approach. But main suru, the concept of main suru, main message is same. And then he also is mentioned, genuine practitioner of Islam should not create any bloodshed. If someone who claim themselves as a Muslim, if creates other sort of bloodshed or violence, essentially no longer be genuine practitioner of Islam. So all religion, theistic religion, a philosophical viewpoint, big differences. But real message, real practice is concerned, it's the same. So we should know these things. So then, philosophical viewpoint, yes. We Buddhists say, oh, your viewpoint is wrong. But that doesn't matter. You see, certain people, the concept of God, Creator, is much more effective. So for that person, the theistic religion is best religion for them. Clear? Do you agree? So I really feel, in any way, we Buddhists, see, even Buddha's time, he never make attempt, entire Indian should become Buddhist. He didn't attempt. Isn't it? In the Vinaya sort of sutra mentioned, unless you see someone approach to you, ask Buddha Dharma, then you have to teach. So till someone asks you teaching, then you teach. So that means if someone did not ask you, then we should not sort of approach to him, you must Buddhist, never do. Clear? So Buddha respect individual's view, individual's right. So within his own sort of follower, again, out of sort of respect, each individual's viewpoint, you see, he taught deliberately different philosophical views. So sometimes I jokingly, you see, expressing, you see, in Buddha's own teaching, contradictory philosophical views mentioned there. This does not mean Buddha's own confusion. One day he taught some philosophical view, certain things. Then next day, another place, he taught different philosophical view. Buddha, he himself not very sure. Confused, no. Nor he deliberately try to create more confusion among his own follower. No. Then answer, Buddha respect different individuals sort of view because of the mental position, mental disposition. So he taught accordingly. All need practice of non-violence, practice of compassion, practice of self-discipline. So for that, you see, different way of approach, different philosophical views, according to suitability to the audience. Like that. So therefore, as I briefly mentioned, you see, we must, as a Buddhist, we must respect all those different religious traditions. It is helping humanity. So once you see we genuinely respect all the different religious traditions, then the mutual respect, mutual understanding come. Once mutual understanding develop, then mutual admiration, mutual respect automatically come. That is the basis of religious harmony. Today, I think we really need that. So now, Sanjay Yandere.
Inconceivable is the qualities of the Buddha, inconceivable the qualities of Dharma, and Zivava, the Sangha. I make this offering to the three inconceivable ones. all the translators ready. So in this world, perhaps we could say, amongst the religious traditions, there are those which have some philosophical explanations, backgrounds, and then there are others which do not have such philosophical backgrounds. Nature, such as religions which worship nature and so forth, like sun, moon, and so forth. So amongst the ones which have philosophical backgrounds, there are theistic and non-theistic schools. And then within the theistic religions, there are those which accept only one God, like Allah, in the case of Islam. Or there is the belief in Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Of course, they have they're basically the same, but there are small differences between these. And then within the non-theistic school religions, there are those who assert moksha, liberation, and those who do not assert it. In certain non-Buddhist religious traditions, such as Sankhya and Jainism, do accept moksha. In certain religious traditions, there are those which do not accept the moksha. So within this school of non-religious traditions, so non-theistic ones, amongst the theistic religions, there are those who believe in reincarnation and also moksha. But with regard to moksha, it is said that the individual souls dissolve into the big self, the God. And then the non-theistic Sankhya school, Jainism and Buddhism believe in causality, law of causality, that things come about only through causes and conditions. And so within this, there is also the teaching on karma. So karma means action. So when we talk about action, we have to relate it with some agent, an actor. And therefore, we can explain karma only in relation to someone who has a mind. Of course, there is some relation to the inanimate things, but mainly when we talk about action, we have an actor. And because of that action, which is created by the actor, there is also a result that is experienced. So through certain specific causes and conditions, we have different results and effects. And then, when we talk about pain and pleasure, as we had already talked yesterday, it has to do with the mind. So the results, which are pain and pleasure, we have to find its cause within the continuity of the mind. And therefore, due to difference in our thought processes, we have different actions that are created, and accordingly there are different consequences. the results, even in this life alone, because of our thoughts. We have different expressions, physical and verbal, and then we also experience pain and pleasure in, on an individual level, in the family, and then in communities. And so in this way we have to think about karma and its cause, its results, karmic causality. So sometimes when we talk about karma, people seem to get the notion that it's not in your hands, not because of what you do, but you can actually blame karma. So this seems to make people rather complacent. So they say, oh, I can't do anything about it because it's karma. So whether something good or bad happens to you, you say, it's my karma. So who caused that karma? It's you who created it. So when we talk about karma, we have say that there's the karma definitely gives rise to its effect. There's a certain karma, and then the karma increases, proliferates, and you will not meet with the results of a certain karma which you have not created. Therefore, what this shows is that you are responsible for what you have experienced, what you experience because of the karma. And so within karma, we have an experiencer of the pain and pleasure, and then the one who creates these. So there is this theory or belief in a soul theory, which Buddhism does not believe in. So except Buddhism, the rest of the religious traditions believe in a soul theory, which in Indian Sanskrit is Atman. So in Buddhism, the reason why the Buddha taught selflessness, so all the religious traditions that existed before the Buddha believed in a separate self or soul, which is different or separate from the body and the mind. And so when we talk about the body, it is only in for this life. You leave it behind. And then when we talk about mind, the grosser level of mind are very much connected with this body. And therefore, when they come to say there is a past and future lives, someone who comes from the past into this life and goes from here to the next, and therefore they have come up with this concept of a soul, with the idea that the body changes. We can talk about my body when I was young, as a child and young man, and middle-aged and old person. You can talk about I was bride when I was young and now I have become duller. And so in relation to these different phases in your life, you have this notion that I am the same person. So therefore there is this notion of an I there. So which is taken for granted. And then, through philosophical assertions, when they came to talk about past and future lives, then they said there is this kind of soul which goes from one life to the next. But when the Buddha checked about this, in many of the non-Buddhist traditions, as I said yesterday, many of the non-Buddhist traditions do talk about the shortcomings and faults of the desire realm, attachment and negative emotions, and then acknowledging these shortcomings and faults, then they came to the practice of restraining yourself and going into the practice of single-pointed concentration. And therefore, when the Buddha saw this, the attachments in relation to the sights and so forth, and then aversion towards others, he said the root of all these, attachment and aversion, come in relation to oneself. Apart from that, you cannot have attachment and aversion. So when you see something attractive, of course, we cannot say, we do not say it's attractive because everyone sees it as beautiful. You say it is beautiful because it's beautiful, attractive to me. And then, accordingly, when you find that attractive, then you become attached to it, desire that. And on the contrary, you have aversion towards others. So, in Tibetan, we have a proverb that you cannot have a clap of one hand clap sound, but you need two hands. And therefore, without relating to yourself, that you cannot talk about something being attractive or ugly. So we can talk about one thing as being attractive to you, but another person may find that to be ugly, feel aversion to that. So, in relation to the person who experiences the beauty or the ugliness, we talk about beautiful attractiveness and unattractiveness in things. Apart from that, there is nothing, no attractiveness and unattractiveness as such. Therefore, the stronger the sense of I you have, then the stronger your attachment will be, the more intense. So there are people who are very selfish and very stubborn. And so even when you crack jokes at them, you have to be very careful with such persons sometimes because they could get very irritated. They would be very irritated. On the other hand, we have other people who are very jolly, and you can crack jokes, any kind of joke, and you will not hurt the person's feeling. And therefore, the stronger the sense of an I, the stronger your attachment and aversion will be. And so the Buddha, so on the common appearance level, the Buddha was born as in a royal family, and then he renounced the kingdom and became a renunciate and a monk. And then he went through contemplation, concentration, practice. Perhaps he may have used the techniques that were already known then. And therefore he saw that this attachment and aversion that we have, he saw it to be related to arising in relation to oneself. And therefore he checked where this I is, what it is. So we have this notion that there is a self which is the master or controller of one's body. So the Buddha said, there is no such a self. And not only that, if there is no self which is separate from the psychophysical aggregates, but then if there is no such a self, then we have this notion that there is a self. We have a notion or a sense of self which is like a master of the body and the mind, and the body and mind are seen as if they are like the servants to it. Therefore, we have some notion of a self which is sufficiently existing. But the Buddha said this is also a distorted view, a wrong conception. And therefore he said the self is designated. labeled. And therefore, the Buddha in Buddhism, there's teaching on selflessness. So I quoted a sutra yesterday. This mind, this notion of I is the devilish mind, is the source of all the views, and the compounded aggregate is empty, and therefore there's no self. So by saying that, do we mean that there is no self at all? Because the Buddha said, just as the chariot is designated on the basis of its parts put together, likewise, on the basis of these body, feeling, the compositional factors, consciousness, and on the basis of these five psychophysical aggregates, we designate or label the I. And therefore, the I exists by way of designation. And in Buddhism, the essence of Buddhism is twofold. The practice of nonviolence, which is the ethical side, and then the philosophical view of dependent origination. So, well, in theistic religions, they say we should not harm others because the others are also creation of God. So I have a Christian friend, who said that because we are created by God, we have also a part of that God in terms of love of God. So it's similar to what we call Tathagata Garbha. So some Christian practitioners say this. So there's something to what they also say. So we also talk about the gene. The father, the children have the genes of the parents. So when we think about somebody as being enemy, we could think even to go to the length of killing, chopping the body up. So when according to theistic religions, when they think that the others are also creation of God, then it helps them to have love and compassion towards others, and helps to overcome the desire, reduce desire and aversion. So as Buddhists, what we believe in is that our pain and pleasure come from, dependent on their causes and conditions. And therefore, if you help others and if you cause them to have happiness, then as a result of it, you also experience happiness. If you bring suffering to others, as a consequence, you also suffer. So your pain and pleasure come from their own compatible causes and conditions. And therefore, since we do not want suffering but happiness, we need to adopt the practices bringing about happiness, and we need to avoid those practices which bring about suffering to us. So this is how we understand the work, how causality works. And then, as we've come across in the 8th chapter, so the reason why we need to avoid harming others is because we do not want suffering. And then this is explained on the basis of the understanding dependent origination. And so dependent origination has this causality, dependent in terms of causality, which all the four philosophical traditions of Buddhism accept. And then when you go deeper into this dependency, we also understand that not only that effect is dependent on its causes, but the cause is also posited on in relation to its effect. So because of having an effect that it brings about, that thing is called its cause, and therefore its identity is achieved. by independence or in relation to the effect that it brings about. And therefore, cause and effect do not have any absolute objective existence unrelated to each other. And similarly, I or self is designated on the, in relation to the psychophysical aggregates, and they themselves also are designated on the in relation to the self, the person. And therefore, we have the dependency in terms of how something is established in relation or in connection with others. And therefore, there's the dependency in terms of designation, according to which comes mainly in the teachings of Master Nagarjuna and his disciples. So we have our traditional religion as Buddhism. Buddhism is our traditional religion, and we need to take care of it. And those whose traditional religion was not Buddhism, if you find Buddhism more suitable, you may adopt it. But in essence, all the religious traditions talk about how to become a good person. So that must be practiced. Now let's turn to the text. So when it comes to practicing Buddhism, as I explained yesterday, we need to progress gradually, step by step, from the first, second, to the third, and so forth. You cannot make transformation all of a sudden. So in Ratnavali, Nagarjuna says, what we want is happiness. And happiness, with regard to happiness, there's happiness of this life and happiness of the future lives. And so these come under the category of the happiness of higher rebirths. And then, with regard to reincarnation, when you overcome all the rebirth as a whole by overcoming the which are brought about by karma and delusions, and we have liberation, nirvana. And then there is also full perfect enlightenment of Buddhahood when you overcome all the defilements that are within the mind stream. So through our actions of body, speech, and mind, which ensue from our delusions, then we become unhappy in this life. And then we also create causes for bad rebirth in the next life as well. And therefore, with regard to the practice in a gradual manner, first we need to avoid the negative actions of body, speech, and mind. And then on the second level is so nobody really intentionally or happily indulge in the bad actions of body, speech, and mind. So why this happens is because of our ignorance. And therefore, the second level is to overcome attachment and aversion based on ignorance. And so the second level is to try to attain nirvana or definite goodness. By overcoming total ignorance completely. And then the third level is to work towards Buddhahood, the non-abiding nirvana, whereby you would have eliminated even the stains left by those negative emotions. So this is how, in the 400 verses, Aryadeva says. And so, first you avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions, 3 of body, and 4 of speech, and then the 3 of mind. So this, these 10 practice of 10 virtuous actions or avoiding 10 non-virtuous actions seems to be there in all the religious traditions, of course, except with a difference in regard to the 10th non-virtuous action, which is wrong view, which could be explained in accordance with the different traditions. And therefore, first we need to practice the morality of avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions. So you should be honest, should not bully others, and be kind. And if you live your life like that, then you'll be living a very good life, a good person. And then you will be friendly with others if you live a moral life. Otherwise, if you try to deceive others, then, of course, people may smile in front of you, but behind you, they are not happy. So at the time of death, sometimes your neighbors might say, oh, when you die, the neighbors might, in fact, instead of mourning, they might have say, that was very good that this person has died. If you live a good life and be friendly with others, be honest and so forth, then when you die, your neighbors would mourn and would really feel dear that they've lost such a good friend, and they will also make prayers for you. And it could even go for several generations that the parents would tell their children about you. Whereas if there's an immoral person, then your legacy would also be recounted from generation to generation, saying that this person was really bad-mannered and so forth. And so if you live a moral life, be kind to others, and the best is to help others, to benefit others, even if you can't, at least do not harm others. So if you do this, then you will be living a good life. So if you live a good life like this, then it's quite sure that you will have a good rebirth in the next life. So if you, otherwise in this life, if you deceive others, steal others' possessions, and commit and rape others and so forth, then you will not have good life in this life. And so, if you live a good life in this life, and with kindness, with kind heart and so forth, it will help you in the next life, surely. And so Aryadeva's 400 verses says, first, avoid the non-meritorious actions, and then in the middle, get rid of his self-grasping, which is talking about overcoming all delusions, negative emotions. And then he says, in the end, destroy all distorted views, which means to realize emptiness, which is to be ascertained through innumerable reasons, and then reach the state of Buddhahood through that. And therefore, this is like a summary that we should keep in mind. And so, with regard to the orderly manner, systematics of practice, Master Adisha wrote The Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. And within that teaching on it, he has taught the parts or practices pertaining to beings of small capacity, which is to say to get rid of the preoccupation and attachment to the pleasures of this life. And then on the second level, we have the teachings pertaining to beings with intermediate capacity, which is to say to even overcome the attachment and ignorance which bring about samsaric existence, to go out of samsara. And then we have the practices pertaining to the beings of great capacity. And so these three do not mean that we have three separate practitioners as such, but even a single individual can do all these practices in a sequential manner. So it applies to an individual. So we need to know how to overcome preoccupation with the pleasures of this life and preoccupation with the pleasures of the next life, and then cultivate love, compassion, and bodhicitta and so forth. And so we need to know these paths. And therefore, when we read through this text by Shantideva, we can actually relate the different practices to the different sections of Lamrim, such as of overcoming the preoccupation with this life. When you come across certain points, then relate that to this kind of practice. And therefore, once you have reduced the preoccupation with this life, pleasures of this life, and your attachment to the pleasures of this life is less, then you will see that even if you may reach have a good rebirth in the next life, that also is still in the nature of suffering. Although you may be out of a very intense kind of suffering, and therefore you need to train your mind in the practices pertaining to the beings of intermediate scope, and then see the shortcomings and disadvantages of or the negative emotions, the afflictive emotions. And relate those practices that are given in this Bodhisattva Charya Avatara to this stage of practice. And then, once you have developed this wish to go out of samsara, then the next step is to develop bodhicitta to help other sentient beings. And then, as with regard to cultivating bodhicitta, you do the seven limb practice found in this text, and then you will cultivate or generate bodhicitta. And once you have generated bodhicitta and you feel that you will be able to engage in the bodhisattva practices, then you should go and do the same by using the lines in this text. And then, once you have develop these experiences, these aspirations, then you can also go into Tantra when you are ready with the common general path. Then you can go into tantric practice. So in this way, Master Adisha actually wrote the lamp for the path to enlightenment, giving these practices in a sequential manner. So if you know this broad framework within which you can fit the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, then it would be very helpful when you read through this text. So we have these kind of practices, called systematic practices, the Shiksha Samuchaya by Shantideva also, but when you want to do practice in a sequential, systematic, and orderly manner, then you need the Lamrim tradition. So we are on page 95, I think, verse number 38. Finished. Verse 39. Both in this world and the next, desires give rise to great misfortune. in this life, killing, bondage and fleeing, and in the next, the existence of the hells. So when I received the teaching on this text from Kuno Lama Denzin Gelsen Rinpoche, he made some corrections. So in the Tibetan, there is this word drup, which means you will achieve the hell realm and so forth in the next life. But he says it should not be achieved, it's just being there. So the part that we are going through is the cultivation or development of the single-pointed concentration. So in connection with that, it talks about avoiding all kinds of distractions. So with regards to distraction, which are obstacle to the single-pointed concentration, there are two main things. One is excitement and distraction itself, and then guapa means excitement. So when your mind goes towards certain other object, you need to bring the mind back to your focus. And so distraction obstructs the mind from staying on the object. And so even though you may be able to stay on the focus that you have chosen, there is another obstacle, which is laxity, and then there is mukpa, cloudiness of mind. So where you are not clear about what you the object. So get rid of cloudiness. So even if you may have cleared yourself of this cloudiness, but then deep in your meditation, you may still have some degree of laxity. And so when you wish to develop the single-pointed concentration, this shamatha, your mind needs to be very alert. And this alertness is obstructed or hindered by this mental laxity. And so mental excitement and laxity are the two main obstacles to developing a single-pointed concentration, shamatha. So when your mind is too high, there is danger of excitement, and when your mind is too low-spirited, then there is a risk of mental laxity. And so you cannot find these experiences outside, but you need to go through, check your own experience. So when you do your meditation and when you feel some kind of happiness, there's some, and if it's too high, then there's more risk of having all kinds of thought processes going on in your mind. Whereas if you feel low spirit, even physically, when you feel heavy, you show it in your face as well. So when you're happy or unhappy, it shows in your face. So similarly in meditation, when your mind is too high, elated, then you need to bring it down. And then when it's too low, spirit, you are too low in spirit, then that also serves as an obstacle to your development of single-pointed concentration. You have to find the balance, always be alert whether these two obstacles are befalling you or not. So sometimes we are not very serious in meditation, and we are not really checking whether these are happening to us or not. So although sometimes when you meditate, you may feel that your mind is focused, but then if you feel some kind of a laxity there, slackenedness in your effort, then you need to come out of that, because then if you go too far into it, you will accumulate laxity. So I have some friends who have done 3 year, 3 month retreat. They have, of course, it's very good that they have really worked hard during that period. And they have told me that they stayed in this meditation, and after coming out of this meditation, 3 year, 3 month meditation, they found themselves to have become duller. Whereas they used to be very bright, they could understand text better, it had decreased. So what has happened is perhaps laxity had accumulated in them. Although they may have thought that they were able to stay focused in their meditation while doing recitation of mantras and so forth, their mind was not so alert in those situations. And so mental excitement and laxity are the two main obstacles to shamatha, because what you need in developing single-pointed concentration is stability of the mind and also clarity. So there should be intensity, I mean brightness and intensity of the mind while you stay focused. So with regard to the object that you choose, it can be anything. So in the initial stage, you should focus your mind on the in and out breath. Just focus your mind on the in and out breath alone. And we talk about the image or reflection of in the meditation, some concentration. There's no such difficulty when you focus your mind on the breath. So, because it's not a very subtle focus or object, nor is it as other for objects like sound and sight and so forth. So you can focus your mind on the in and out breath, count them, 1, 2, and so forth. You can do it 21 times or 100 times or several hundred times. So the focus is to bring your mind in focus, withdraw it from not causing distraction to you. And so this is something that non-Buddhist traditions also do. And then in Theravada tradition, they do this in Burma, Thailand, and so forth. They have this meditation focusing on in and out breath. And then there are other focuses that you may choose. There are objects for doing analysis. So it's very vast. So whatever you choose, you have to have the focus, the object, clearly in your mind, and then focus your mind on it. Or you can use the mind itself as the focus of your meditation for shamatha. Or you can choose in impermanence as the object. So you need to do analytical meditation in this. When you are certain that things are momentarily changing, that they are disintegrating momentarily. When you find certainty in that, then conviction, you draw the conviction that things are momentarily disintegrating, then you focus your mind on that without doing analysis. So first do analytical meditation and then focus your mind on it. So in order to familiarize mind your mind with this, then you focus your mind on that object. So there are those meditations where you have some object and then you form the image of that in your mind. And other meditations like compassion, loving kindness, in these meditations you actually bring up these experiences within yourself and then focus your mind on it. And then when your mind kind of becomes little dull and you're not clear about the object that you're meditating on, then you need to come out of that and do analytical meditation. And then with regard to the duration, in the beginning it should be short, and then as you become more and more adept, you need to do longer durations. So maybe you can do 4 times a day in the morning, then in the afternoon, and at dusk. So those who are busy with work, maybe you can do meditation in the morning before going to work, and then after coming back from work, you can do some meditation. And on weekends, you have more time, perhaps. So instead of going outside for sightseeing, going outside, but go on sightseeing of your mind only. And so you need to divide your time between the meditation session and the in-between sessions, the post-meditation sessions. So in-between sessions should be used to study the text, and you may do other things you need to do. And so during the meditation, post-meditation sessions, you still need to carry on with the feelings that you have developed in the meditation session. And then, with regard to the meditation, we have the attachment, anger, and ignorance. These are the main obstacles. So when you see something which you dislike, you have aversion. Whereas if you have something attractive, you become attached. And so with regard to preconceptions, there is this anger that is provoked by someone whom you consider to be your enemies. And so when you encounter such people, you need to practice patience, and which this is found in the patience chapter, the 6th chapter. So anger actually causes us to not feel close to other sentient beings. And so it is an obstacle for developing this loving kindness towards others. And then you also feel that those who harm your near and dear ones also to be your enemies. And so, as it is said in the 8 verses of mind training, you should practice patience and feel those sentient beings who cause you harm dear to yourself. And so, The sixth chapter is very good for practicing patience, and the obstacle to practice patience is the anger, and this is the opportunity for practicing patience is actually offered by those who provoke anger in you, who harm you. So because you feel distant from them, because they harm you or hurt you, but instead of feeling distant from you, you should feel them to be very kind to you because of giving this opportunity. And therefore, chapter on patience is very important, because it teaches us that our enemy is our teacher, spiritual teacher. And so, to get rid of the anger, we have the sixth chapter in this text, practice of patience. And then, to get rid of ignorance, we develop wisdom, which is taught in the ninth chapter. And then, in this chapter, what is taught is the antidote to the attachment. So, we may develop attachment towards things which are good. So here, mainly, what is mentioned is the shortcomings of or faults of sexual desire. So as I said yesterday, and this text was taught in a monastic community by Master Shantideva on one of the bi-monthly confession sessions, days. And so it was taught to monks. And therefore, in order for the monks to avoid the attachment to, in relation to women, it shows the shortcomings or the faults of the body of a woman. And so now you have to switch it to, when you switch it to female practitioners or female the nuns, then when they do this meditation, they have to switch their focus on the filthiness of the body. So I have a friend who says that she didn't like Master Shantideva because Shantideva despises women too much. And so she was a feminist. And so she talked about that Shantideva was male chauvinist. And so that's not the case. Because this teaching was given to monks, he mentions the faults of a woman's body, whereas for practitioners who are women, they should think about the faults of the men's body. So verse number 39. So there are desires in relation to our body, our wealth, and our near and dear ones. So even in this life, when we become angry, it's actually because of our attachment to something. And then the political crises that happen in different countries and conflicts are happening because of attachment, and therefore which gives rise to such anger and hatred, because you are attached to one's own side. And then you think your side and yourself, what do you do is the best. And then when somebody else does something which is against your wish, then you become angry. And so whether it's on an individual level, or family level, or community, or the problems of 7 billion people, they are because of our attachments. And so if we let ourselves be carried away by this attachment, then we will cause ourselves misfortune in this life, and in the next lives, we will be reborn in an animal realm, a hell realm, and so forth. So, in other words, if we let attachments rule us, then we will suffer. And so all this is because of attachment. And then we have attachments from male and female that have attachment to one another. So verse 40, for the sake of women, many requests are first of all made through go-betweens. All forms of transgressions, even notoriety, are not avoided for their sake. I engage in fearful deeds for them and will even consume my wealth. But these very bodies of theirs, which I greatly enjoy in sexual embrace, are nothing other than skeletons. And 42 finished. And so when we have marriage ceremonies or arrangements for marriage between girls and boys, and there are many things go before the actual marriage. So whether you are a man or women, if you think about the body to which you are attached, so this says are nothing other than skeletons which are covered by our flesh and skin, and they are not autonomous and are identityless. Rather than being so desirous and completely obsessed, so the beauty that you see doesn't have any objective existence. But because you are attached to them, why do I not go to a state beyond sorrow instead? In the first place, I made efforts to lift this veil, and when it was raised, she bashfully looked down. Previously, whether anyone looked or not, her face was covered with a cloth. Yet now, why do I run away upon directly beholding this face which disturbs the mind as it is being revealed to me by the vultures? Previously, I completely protected her body when others cast their eyes upon it. Why, miser, do you not protect it now while it's being devoured by these birds? So, with regard to the spouses, whether you're male or female, when somebody else looks at your spouse, you become angry, but this very body to which you are attached is the same body when the person was alive, and therefore there is nothing to be attached or desire about. Since vultures and others are eating this pile of meat that I behold, why do I offer flower garlands and sandalwood and ornaments to that which is now the food of others? So if you are attached to the flesh of the body, then the vultures and others are eating this pile of meat that I behold. Why do I offer flower garlands and sandalwood and ornaments? So in the end, this very body becomes fuel for fire, or it is eaten by vultures and others. They become food for others. So to that which now the food of others. So you have held such a body to be very dear. If I'm frightened by the skeletons I see, even though they do not move, why am I not frightened by walking corpses which are moved around by a few impulses, although I'm attached to it? When it is covered with skin, why do I not desire it when it is uncovered? So when we see zombies, we become afraid. We are scared of them. But so while people move around as they are alive, in reality, what we see is like people who are like zombies. So when you have a great attachment and desire to something, and when you meditate on these faults and shortcomings, then it helps to reduce your attachment. Of course, when some meditators visualize that the whole land is filled with skeletons, this helps them to overcome their desire and attachment. When the desire and attachment are very intense, when you meditate on these, this helps. So when we have attachment, there is a reification of the beauty that we see. It's not that there is absolute beauty in the object as such, but we create some, as Master Nagarjuna says, that because of inattention or some kind of distorted view, we become attached to things. So I have Aaron Beck. So I know one scientist, a psychiatrist. The father of modern cognitive therapy, Aaron Beck, told me that when people become angry at someone, the ugliness that they see in the other person is 90% of that is our own projection, mental projection. He said that. So this is exactly what Master Nagarjuna also has said. Because when we become attached to our verse, first we hold on to some absolute beauty or ugliness, and then we exaggerate the beauty and the ugliness. So there's an exaggeration because of our attachment or aversion. So just as this attachment and anger are exaggerated ways of looking at the two objects, likewise, if we also do meditation on the whole land being filled with skeletons, it helps. Of course, that also may seem like an exaggeration, that although the whole land is not filled with skeleton, but when you do that meditation, it helps to reduce this attachment.
Okay.
So why do I dislike acrimin and find joy in saliva? Cotton, too, is soft to the touch, but while I find no sexual delight in a pillow, I think that a woman's body does not emit a putrid odor. Lustful one, you are confused as to what is unclean, thinking that they cannot sleep with this cotton, although it is soft to the touch. Confused, negative, and lustful people become angry towards it instead. If I am not attached to what is unclean, then why do I copulate with the lower parts of others' body, which aren't nearly cages of bones, tied together with muscles and plastered over with the mud of flesh? So this body is shown as being full of filth. I myself contain many unclean things, which I constantly have to experience. So why? Because of an obsession for uncleanness do I desire other bags of filth? So when someone is kind to you, of course, we become we like them, and then we become attached to it, but then the mind of the other person cannot be touched. our sin, but we become attached to the body of the person. So what is more important is the mind. So I usually tell people that, of course, external beauty, physical beauty is beautiful, important, necessary, but then the inner beauty is more important, because if you lack that, then external beauty will not be so good, because you may be friends for some days, and then you will fight with each other. And so internal beauty is more important than external beauty.
So sometimes I how teasing those young ladies who spend a lot of money for what call cosmetic. Cosmetic. So that is the physical beauty. The physical beauty, no question, important. But more important is inner beauty. without inner beauty, on the level of just external beauty, they marry, perhaps within a few days, quarrel start. And then divorce. With children, terrible. Without children, then, okay, you have some freedom, whether divorce or not, that's up to you. So all this is very much related with inner beauty. Many years ago, you see, one Tibetan government official, monk official, a very good one, really, a trusted sort of official. I know him very well. So later, he disrobed. Then I teased him, "Oh, your wife, not that much sort of attractive." Then his response is, "Yes, physical not much attractive, but internal beauty is excellent." Then I have nothing to say. He win. So, what a Dirisha.
But it is this flesh that I enjoy. If this is what I wish to touch, and behold, why do I not desire it in its natural state, devoid of any mind? Furthermore, any mind that I may desire is unable to be touched or beheld, and whatever I am able to touch, I will not be mental. So why indulge in this meaningless copulation? It is not so strange that I do not understand the bodies of others to be of unclean nature, but it is indeed strange that I do not understand why my very own body to be by nature unclean. Having forsaken the young lotus flower, unfolded by beams of sunlight free from cloud, why, with the mind craving for what is unclean, do I revel in a cage of filth? Since I do not wish to touch a place that is smeared with excrement, then why do I wish to touch the body from which that excrement arose? If I am not attached to what is unclean, why do I copulate with the lower parts of this body which arise from unclean filths of a womb and are produced by the seeds within it? I have no wish for a small dirty maggot which has come from a pile of filth, so why do I desire this body which by nature is grossly unclean, for it too was produced by filth? Not only do I not disparage the uncleanness of my own body, grace for tea, but because of an obsession for what is unclean, I desire other bags of filth as well. verse number 64 finished. So when we have strong attachments to in relation to somebody, then we need to do this kind of meditation thing. You need to open the body. First, take out the skin. Take off the skin, and you'll see all the flesh and veins. And then you further open the body. You'll find the bones, skeletons, and then inside it, the bone marrows. And when you are attached to a beautiful face, if you do this kind of meditation, opening up the body, open the head, take off the skull, and if you take the skull off, then you'll see something which is really repulsive. And then when you go inside the body, you see the organs and then the intestines. So we are born from the sperm and ovum of parents, which are filthy, dirty substances. And then this body is like a machine for producing filth. So we eat food, and then they go into our body, and then they are processed in the body, and then they come out as urine and feces. And so we are born from filthy substances. We have obtained this filthy body, which is a machine for producing filth, waste product. So all the food that we take in our life, of course, it helps to sustain the body, but they produce all these feces, the waste products that we have let out of the body. So in the sense, verse 65. Okay. So 71, furthermore, these unclean female bodies are not found within without paying a price. So the relationship between couples are built by spending money and then doing all kinds of things, and then they come together. And in order to obtain them, I exhaust myself in future will be, and in future will be endured in the hells. As a child, I'm unable to increase my wealth. And as a youth, what can I do? So by acquiring wealth, then you find some spouse. And at the end of my life, when I have the wealth, being an old man, what's good will sex be then? Some malicious and lustful people wear themselves out by working all day, and when they return home in the evening, they exhaust their exhausted body lie prostrate like corpses. 74, some have the suffering of being disturbed with travel and having to go a long way from home. Although they long for their spouses, they do not see them for years at a time, and some who wish for benefit due to confusion even sell themselves for the sake of So you become servant to others, but not attaining what they wish. They are aimlessly driven by the winds of others' actions. Some sell their own bodies, and without any power employed by others, even when their wives give birth, their children fall at the feet of trees and on lonely places. And 77 also finished. So in the sutra, whether you are wealth or poor, wealthy or poor, living in a household life, you need to take care of your spouses and also the dear relatives, and you are in lots of trouble sometimes. So although you may not discriminate against others and take side of your near and dear ones, but you sometimes get involved in troubles. And then after marrying somebody, you'll maybe give birth to some child, and then the child will grow up and get a good education, and then marry somebody, and then you will again have family relations with the boy or the girl's family, and then so as a householder you have problems when you have children. All kinds of problems arise because of children, and when you have no children again, also there is some problem. And so the monastic life of monks and nuns do not have to go through these kind of problems that the lay people have. So lay people go through all kinds of ups and downs. There's happiness, sorrow, and then in between feelings. So the monks and nuns do not have to go through this, and therefore there is praise of celibacy in the sutras. And so the monks and nuns should contemplate these and become joyful in keeping their vows. So up to this, what is shown is the attachment to internal objects, sensual objects. So sometimes people are so poor that they do not have enough food that lasts for days. So they may have something to eat and drink today, but they are concerned what would they do the next day. There are many people like that in Africa or India or in China. It seems there are lots of problems in remote places. And then there's a problem of overpopulation. So at the end of this century, it is said that the population of this earth would be 10 billion. So due to global warming, there's lots of disturbances in the external climate. And then the major resources also, we have insufficient major resources.
There are some indication now, the limitation. Limitation is one way. Then, due to global warming, the nature disaster, it seems increasing. So now I think 7 billion human beings now should think global level on the basis of some kind of sort of sense of oneness of 7 billion human beings. This is something humanity facing problem. With such sort of reality, still we very much emphasize we and they. I think that very, very narrow, sort of short-sighted and narrow-minded. Some really serious things now there. So we have to sort of face these problems. So the entire humanity work together at full cooperation, I think, really necessary, isn't it? So sometimes I think nature disaster or these problems, I think grateful, these show us you must unite. The strong concept of we and they, that outdated now. So as a Buddhist, we always praying entire sentient being, isn't it? So at least human being, of course other animal, we cannot much sort of help. Of course we can do more, protect their life. See, less sort of harm, overfishing. And then beef farm or poultry. Immense suffering, isn't it? All these we created. So the key thing is we human beings sort of mind you see, eventually become more compassionate mind, then I think we, not only we ourselves, you see, become happier, no sort of killing, no bully, no telling lie, and then not only that, but entire sort of different form of life on this planet become more safer, more comfortable, less suffering. So every person who sort of say, who's chanting entire mother-centered being, I think should think this. Then we become more realistic. Otherwise, sometimes I used to telling with respect to people, to public talk, I telling religion, if you not sincerely practice, then religion teaches us hypocrisy, saying nice things. And real daily life, not much differences, isn't it? We should be honest, truthful, compassionate. This not just because of the point of something holy or something. It's now we really need that. Everybody wants a happy life, peaceful life, peaceful world. Who destroy? Who are destroying? Destroyer of peace. Not sky, not space, not these vegetation, but our mind. So logically, the peace means we must develop peace here. Peace will not come from outside. And also I often used to telling people, peace will not achieve through prayer. If God or Buddha have full ability to bring peace, then I think 1,000 years on this planet must be very peaceful. So peace must develop through action, through motivation. Okay, that also is a part of practice of bodhicitta. So, So now here, the modern life, materialistic life, so sometimes you see create more problem. I mentioned, you see, with this body, human body, but our mental way of thinking is almost like an animal. Just we totally relying on sensorial experiences. We have this human intelligence, thinking power, which other animals cannot do. So we must utilize, as a human being, must utilize our brain, our mental ability, not just totally relying on sensorial experiences. That is the non-punctu taya shivrachas.
So it's got a food, shelter, and places to live. Even the insects need them, and they do work hard to achieve them. So we as human beings have this marvelous intelligence to think about long-term benefit. If we cannot use it, then it's really sad. If we cannot use it well. So some lustful people even cut their bodies, others impale themselves on points of sticks, some stab themselves in with daggers. So if you live your life in a bad way by bullying others, by cheating others, and in the worst cases, killing others, and live your life like that, then you will be suffering in the next lives as well. Due to the torment involved in collecting it, protecting and finally losing it, I should realize wealth to be fraught with infinite problems. Those who are distracted by their attachment to it have no opportunity to gain freedom from the misery of conditioned existence. In the same way as animals drawing carriages are only able to eat a few mouthfuls of grass, likewise desirous people have many disadvantages such as these and little profit. And since even animals cannot obtain this little profit, those who are pained by their previous actions waste this leisure endowment so difficult to find for the sake of something trivial that is not so scarce. The object of desire will certainly perish. And then they shall fall in hellish states. However, Buddhahood itself is attained with just 1/1,000,000th of a difficulty involved in continually exhausting myself for the sake of what is not of great, very great. Hence, the desires experience greater misery than those following the awakening way of life. But for them, there is no awakening. So from verse number 83 down, shows the practice or cultivation of bodhicitta. So we say that education is very important. which means that we acknowledge that we, if we do not have education, if we lack knowledge, then it is to our own disadvantage. So we as human beings have this ability to make distinction between what is short-term benefit and long-term benefit. And therefore, when we seek the long-term benefit, so we just indulging in the sensual pleasures related to the sensory perceptions, we will not be able to overcome the real unhappiness. So you can distract yourself with beautiful sights and sounds and so forth, or have a good food in restaurants, or look at some paintings. But if there is a problem in the family, that has not still been resolved. And so you should think about how to solve the problem that you have at home and use your mind, and also to have the courage to work hard to solve that problem. So without really using the mind, but just listening to some music, when you have the problem, while you have the problem, if you try to distract yourself with music or some sound or something, food, then the problem will not go away. So Buddhism is about making transformation by using our mind, making change in the mind itself by using reason. You should see the benefits, long-term and short-term, and for oneself and others and so forth. You should have a very broad-mindedness. So with regard to meditation, there's nothing greater than cultivation of bodhicitta. So as I said yesterday, if you have a good heart, warm heart, then this is the root of all happiness. Wherever such a kind hearted person is, there is happiness. Brothers, even cats and dogs who are very gentle and kind to others, they live with others more harmoniously. Whereas if there are dogs which fight with others, dogs and cats, then they will, this dog or cat will remain lonely. And so kindness, warm-heartedness means not harming others and helping others and respecting others. So these are sources of happiness, main sources of happiness. Our unhappiness comes from fear, jealousy, and competitive feeling. So these factors are there because of selfishness, and then whereby you think that others are troublemakers for you, and then you become distant from others. And because of that, suspicion grows in you, and then you become unhappy and then angry. And so, to those whom you feel suspicious or fear and so forth, if you be kind to them, if you be good to them, then the fear and suspicion and so forth will go away. So kindness and compassion and love will bring others to you, and then you will have friends. And then there's no reason for becoming angry, and then raping others and stealing others' possessions and killing others. If you have love and compassion towards them, these will not happen. So even if you may be avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions, but if you do it with love and compassion towards others, there will be more powerful. So you may avoid doing harm to others, avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions, just because you don't want to suffer. And of course, you can do that practice and you will reach the nirvana and so forth. But bodhisattvas dedicate for the well-being of others and therefore avoid the non-virtuous actions. And so if you have a good heart, warm heart, then you will create cause within yourself so that your mental peace is not disturbed at all. If you remain selfish, everything else would create suspicion for you. And so all unhappiness is rooted in this extreme self-centered attitude. And therefore, as an antidote to it, you should cherish others more than yourself. So, cherishing others seems to be holy, but it is the means by which you can actually fulfill your own goal. So I usually say bodhisattvas are very wisely selfish, because they think of others, and then as a result, byproduct of that, they have happiness. Whereas we remain very selfish, self-centered, and as a result, we suffer, we are unhappy. And therefore, to cherish others means you will create causes for higher rebirth in the next life, and then you remain happy in this life as well. So if the animals do not have such an opportunity to practice this kind of cherishing others, so if while we have this human body and human intelligence, if we live like animals, it's really sad. So in order to cultivate bodhicitta, of course there are other texts which mention about thinking about all sentient beings as being ones, near and dear ones, father, mother, and relatives, and so forth. These are mentioned in the Perfection of Wisdom's teachings. So taking these sources, there is the system where of cultivating bodhicitta by recognizing that all sentient beings have been once mother, and before that you do meditation on develop equanimity, and then recognize all sentient beings as one's mother and having been kind to you, and then wanting to repay their kindness, and then you develop kindness and affectionate love, and then compassion, and finally, extraordinary resolve, and finally, develop bodhicitta. Now, here, the development of bodhicitta is done in a way that, in such a way that you should think that you are only a single person, others are limitless, and therefore you avoid harming others. So even with regard to higher rebirths in this life, you survive for your food, clothing, shelter, and fame, and so forth. You depend on others. And then for the next life, you should have a higher rebirth. In the next life, you should keep the morality of avoiding 10 non-virtuous actions, and then practicing the 10 the perfections, and then making a firm prayer for this. And then, for through that, you attain the higher, definite goodness or the nirvana, which comes through the practice of the three trainings of morality, concentration, and wisdom. And the final, the ultimate definite goodness is omniscient state of Buddhahood, which comes from Bodhicitta, which is rooted in love and compassion, and helped by wisdom realizing emptiness. And so, whether it's a temporary goal of happiness or the happiness in the next in this life or the next life, or definite goodness, nirvana, or final ultimate enlightenment of Buddhahood. Everything, all these good things, everything good for to us comes from holding others to be happy, being compassionate to others. So, because of bodhicitta, the bodhisattvas have attained their realizations, these profound experiences, and then the Buddhas have become Buddhas because of the practice of bodhicitta. And therefore, when you see the great qualities of great qualities of Buddhahood, then you will find admiration, admire bodhicitta more. So even for temporary benefit, if you have compassion, you have the good qualities that you develop, but all the misfortunes that we encounter are because of lack of self-cherishing attitude. So therefore, you need to think about the faults of self-cherishing attitude and the excellent qualities of cherishing others, and then you exchange self and others. So far, we have neglected others' happiness, we have disregarded their happiness and well-being. But now we have to switch our attitudes to considering others to be more important than oneself, knowing that you have the greatest benefit from this. And so if you think about more about others, you dedicate for the well-being of others, then you draw the final ultimate benefit. You also fulfill your own goal, as Jejong Boche Tsongkhapa has said, that you intend to help others, but as a byproduct, you also fulfill your own goal as well. And so, for equalizing and exchanging others, what is the root of it? That is compassion. So compassion is this attitude of wishing others to be out of suffering. But you need to know, for here you need to know what suffering is. So you would know that if you don't know what causes suffering, then you will see that the suffering can be ended. If you don't know the cause of suffering, then you will just make some prayers or you feel helpless to help other sentient beings. So because of our ignorance, we cause all kinds of problems. Now we need to see whether this ignorance is something, a valid knowledge or not. You'll find that it is a DOST misconception. And therefore, since it's a misconception, you have to check whether what it sees in ourselves and others is a fact or reality. You'll find that it is not a fact. And therefore, you'll see that this ignorance has some antidote which can end it. And therefore, understanding emptiness helps to overcome this ignorance, and you will see that whether it's for attaining nirvana, liberation for yourself, or you think of liberating others, you need this wisdom realizing emptiness as well. So the actual meditation on emptiness itself comes in the next chapter. But in order to develop that wisdom which serves as antidote to cut ignorance and direct perception, direct experience of emptiness, to develop that you need single-pointed concentration. And therefore, so in understanding emptiness is important in the beginning, middle, and end. So developing the bodhicitta for which you develop this attitude of equaling and exchanging self and others, what you need to first develop is that equality of everybody. You should develop here, the equanimity is not just seeing everyone as one's relatives and so forth, but so since oneself and others wants happiness and not suffering, you are equal in that respect. So whether you are knowledgeable or illiterate or poor or wealth and so forth, we all want happiness and not want suffering. And so we all have the same right to achieve happiness and to overcome suffering. So it's not given by someone else, but because we ourselves have this instinct, this natural wish to be happy and not suffering, we have the right to achieve that. So first of all, I should make an effort to meditate upon the equality between self and others. Verse number 19, I should protect all beings just as I do myself, because we are all equal in wanting pleasure and not wanting pain. Although there are many different parts and aspects, such as the hand, as a body that is to be protected, they are one. So all the limbs and other parts of the body should be protected because they are part of the same body. So likewise, all sentient beings who do not want suffering but want happiness, sentient beings in the six realms of existence, all of them, you should see that, take yourself as an example, saying that just as I do not want suffering and want happiness, likewise all sentient beings have the same wish. Likewise, all the different sentient beings, in their pleasure and their pain, have a wish to be happy that is the same as mine. The suffering that I experience does not cause any harm to others. So, of course, your suffering will not harm others. But because you don't want suffering but happiness, likewise, but that suffering is mine because of my conceiving myself as I, thereby it becomes unbearable. So the suffering of others may not harm you as such, but if you think carefully, your happiness is dependent on others. So there is no one which can live alone. Maybe some animals in the wild who may live alone for some time, but when the mating season comes, they come together. And so they depend on others. So even small animals live together, depending on one another. when I was in Swark Ashram, nearby to Shita, I watched some moths laying their eggs, and when the eggs hatched, the caterpillar. So caterpillars come out and they just remain alone without any protector or guardian. And so the mother lays a whole bunch of eggs together, and all these eggs actually to live together. And then I have noticed that there are certain bees which kept prey on these caterpillars. And when these bees came by, all these caterpillars, they all moved together. So they may not have any other understanding, but they know that they have to live together, survive together, and therefore they make some movement. And in Ladakh recently, there was lots of insects. So they get hurt very easily. Even at the touch of a finger, they get... It makes them something. So I was quite sad to see all these, because we can't do much about them. So we all they also want happiness and not want suffering. And so when you familiarize your mind with thinking that they have happiness and not suffering, and then you'll feel, when you feel closer, when they feel closer to you, then you'll feel their sufferings unbearable. Likewise, the 93, the misery of others does not befall me. Nevertheless, by conceiving of others as I, their suffering becomes mine. Therefore, it too should be hard to bear. So the suffering is something that is unwanted. Hence, I should dispel the misery of others because it is suffering, like just like my own, and I should benefit others because they are sentient beings, just like myself. So this is not only about some religious belief or some law, but merely the fact that nobody wants suffering but happiness. So when both myself and others, page 905, when both myself and others are similar in that we wish to be happy, what is so special about me? Why do I strive for my happiness alone? So what is the reason? Why do we think only about our own happiness? It is because of this self-cherishing attitude that in turn comes about because of our ignorance about the reality. And when both myself and others are similar in that we do not want to wish to suffer, what is so special about me? Why do I protect myself and not others? So why do I protect my own self from suffering so dearly and not others, not that of others? 97, why should I protect them? If their suffering does not cause me any harm, then why protect myself against future suffering if it causes me no harm now? So, of course, others' suffering may not affect you, not harm you directly, but because others are suffering, and as social animals, especially we human beings as social animals, we need to live together and depend on others. And therefore, it's quite foolish if we don't think about, if we disregard the suffering of others. So if you think about an agricultural field, in order to have a good harvest, to make a good profit, we will take care of the land well. So of course, It's not because we have compassion to the land as such, but because we make profit from the harvest that comes from the crop. So we usually we cherish money, but money cannot show us any love. So if I usually tell this joke, some half jokingly tell people that maybe some people have diamond rings, and if you kiss the diamond ring or the gold ring, and the gold ring or the diamond ring will not show any love to you. There's no response from that. Instead of that, if we show affection to the cats and dogs, they also respond accordingly. So similarly, although the inanimate objects like the field and so forth are not cannot show you love, but because it helps you, you can actually you take care of them. And therefore, we need to take care of sentient beings, because in dependence on them, we draw the short-term and long-term benefit. If we disregard them, that is very immoral, because they are the source of our happiness and joy. Giving some gifts with a selfish motive and giving something with the wish to help others, there's great difference in the result of these two. And so, altruistic attitude is the source of all our goodness and happiness and joy. And if you have some intelligence, you need to cultivate bodhicitta. You need to cultivate wisdom realizing emptiness. Then you become a good moral and a worthy practitioner of Buddhism. So it says, then why protect myself against future suffering if it causes me no harm now? So you want to protect yourself from suffering in the future, therefore you do something to help yourself now. So likewise, you have to help overcome suffering, protect others. It is a mistaken conception to think that I shall experience the suffering of my next life. For it is another person who dies, and another that will be reborn. So you have this notion of an objectively existing absolute or an independently existent I. So when you think that it is me who will suffer in the next life, there is this sense of holding on to some kind of permanence in oneself from in this life and the next. Surely, whenever there is suffering, the sufferer must protect themselves from it. Yet the suffering of foot is not that of the hand. Why then does one protect the other? Although this may not be justified, it is done because of grasping at itself. Yet, surely, whatever is not justified by myself and others should at all cost be rejected. So because of holding the previous and later moments to be of the same and one entity, therefore we have this kind of attitude of thinking of protecting oneself. Such things as a continuum and an aggression are false in the same way as prayer beads are and an army. So when we talk about continuum, there is always some continuity to things, whether it's the mind or in the matter. When it comes to the very subtle level of these particles, quarks and so forth, maybe they still have some movement, and that shows that there is some continuity in them as well. And so whether it's in mind or consciousness or inanimate things, matter, all of them are formed through aggregation of different parts. When you take those parts, break down the parts, then you will not find anything that you can point to as being this or that. There is no real honor of suffering, therefore, who has control over it? So this shows emptiness. There being no inherent honor of suffering, so whether it's pain or pleasure, there is no honor or the self which experiences them. And if you look at the self as being present and apart from the past and future, there's no present as well. So there can be no distinction at all between myself and others. Thus I should dispel it because it hurts. Why am I so certain that I should eliminate the suffering of others? So since suffering is something which is unwanted by anyone, therefore we must work to eliminate suffering of others. Why? There's no reason why we should think only of others. But why should I turn away the misery of all? There's no ground for argument, for if I prevent myself, surely I should prevent the suffering of all. If not, since I am just like sentient beings, I should not prevent my own suffering either. So since this compassion will bring me much misery, why should I exert myself to develop it? So when you develop compassion, of course, you may seem to have more suffering, more sorrow. So this question arises. Should I contemplate the suffering of living creatures? How could the misery of compassion be more? So sentient beings are limitless, infinite, like the expanse of the space. So when you think about the suffering of such a number of sentient beings, it's almost true that you cannot say that cultivating compassion would give you more misery. So as I said earlier, if others are happy, you also are happy. And if others are unhappy and have suffering, and you avoid them, their suffering, then it is very immoral of you. It's really... bad to do that. And so there's nobody who forces you to have this compassion, cultivate compassion. But you should see the suffering of others and voluntarily develop this compassion and to think of eliminating others' suffering. And then you feel unbearable, the suffering of others as unbearable. So although it may seem that you have your peace of mind is disturbed, but then deep down there is huge confidence within yourself. So when you voluntarily think of the suffering of others, you are thinking of their suffering to take on their suffering voluntarily with confidence, full confidence. And therefore, there is difference. And so how could the misery of compassion be more? If by one person suffering, the suffering of many would be destroyed, surely kind-hearted people would accept it for the sake of themselves and others. So when you take on the suffering of others, so if it could help many others, then for an intelligent person, this is something worthy to practice.
So it's a slight disturbance that happens because of thinking of others' suffering and compassion. You have to voluntarily and happily take on the suffering of others. So thus the Bodhisattva Supushpachantra, although aware of the harm the king would cause him, accepted his own suffering in order to eradicate the miseries of many. So here one story about Bodhisattva Supushpachantra is related. Thus, because they love to pacify the pains of others, those whose minds are attuned in this way would enter even the deepest hell. So on the one hand, the mind may seem to be very difficult to tame, but then if you think closer, I mean, you can actually make these changes within yourself, so it seems very fragile and delicate and flexible as well. So would enter even the deepest hell, just as a wild goose plunges into a lotus pool. And so if you acquaint your mind with these love, compassion, then you will be able to have these experiences. And so there was a Kadamba master told his friend that I'm making one prayer, but it seems that it's not being fulfilled. So the master said that he called on to others to do some prayers and talk offering. And so one of his disciples or friends asked him, "You are always meditating on compassion, cultivating compassion. So what is there that you seem not to be fulfilling?" So I have always been wishing to be reborn in the hell realm, but now my prayer for that prayer is not being fulfilled. And I'm not able to fulfill that because what I see is indications of myself being reborn in Sukhavati land. And then Toyon Lama has made this prayer, "May I never become enlightened. And until the end of space, may I be reborn in on the hell realms, lower realms of existence." And so one Lama said that when he was in his 80s, told his disciples, the first Dalai Lama, I think, that I have now become old and so forth. And his disciples told him that you have been had this prophecy that you would be reborn in a pure land. But the first Dalai Lama said, "I never had this wish to be born in a pure land, Sukhavati and so forth, but I always have this wish to be born in the samsara." Thus, because they love to pacify the pains of others, those whose minds are tuned with in this way would enter even deepest hell, just as a wild goose plunges into lot. Will not the ocean of joy that shall exist when all beings are free be sufficient for me? What am I doing wishing for liberation, my liberation alone? So if we still become servants of our self-cherishing attitude, then we, as humans, have not been able to fulfill our goal. So what am I doing wishing for my liberation alone? So in Nagarjuna's Bodhicitta Vivarana, he has also said a very powerful verse relating to this. Therefore, although working for the benefit of others, I should not be conceited or consider myself wonderful. And because of the joy there is in solely doing this, I should have no hope for any ripening effect. Therefore, just as I protect myself from unpleasant things, however small, in the same way I should act towards others with a compassionate and caring mind, although the basis is quite impersonal. Through constant familiarity, I have come to regard the drops of sperm and blood of others as I. So in the same way, why should I be unable to regard the bodies of others as I? Hence, it is not difficult to see that my body is not that of others. So from the beginning of this samsara until today, we have been self-cherishing ourselves alone. And now, having born in this life, we have met with having met with the teachings of the Buddha, and also these teachings being demonstrated as being true by the great masters of the past. You should think of now holding others to be more. You should see the faults of self-cherishing attitude. So having seen the mistakes in cherishing myself and the ocean of good in cherishing others, I shall completely reject all selfishness and accustom myself to accepting others. So selfishness here doesn't refer to selfish attitude, but it refers to the lack of understanding of selflessness, reality. In the same way as the hands and so forth are regarded as limbs of the body, likewise, why are embodied creatures not regarded as limbs of a life? Through acquaintance has the thought of I arisen toward this impersonal body. So in a similar way, why should it not arise towards our living beings? When I work in this way for the sake of others, I should not let conceit and feeling that I am wonderful to arise. It is just like feeding myself, I hope for nothing in return. Therefore, just as I protect myself from unpleasant things, however slight, in the same way, I should habituate myself to have a compassionate and caring mind towards others. It is out of this great compassion that the Lord of Lokiteshvara has even blessed his name to dispel the nervousness of being among other people. I should not turn away from what is difficult. And by the power of familiarity, I may be made unhappy. So, of course, I have no experience of bodhicitta, but I feel they're quite close to bodhicitta, as if the bodhicitta were my next-door neighbor. So I still find it difficult. I found it difficult to cultivate bodhicitta in the beginning. But in the 70s, I first received teachings on the Bodhisattvacharya Avatara, these texts from Kunlama Tenzin Gelsen Rinpoche. And then the second time, I received teaching on this text from. So the lineage that Kunlun Lama Rinpoche held with regard to this teaching and is the Dzogchen Zabedu Rinpoche's lineage, a Dzogchen master from Kham region of Tibet. And then the second time I received this teaching from Tushig Rinpoche, so who received this teaching from Hlundrup Tsundu Rinpoche, one of the garden throne holders, Hlundrup Tsundu. So he, so therefore this may be the Gelug lineage. And so after receiving teachings on these this text, then I gave thought to bodhicitta. And then I felt closer to bodhicitta, and I feel that if I could really meditate and cultivate it, I may be able to attain the path of accumulation, as I usually refer to the mantra of the Heart Sutra, Gate Gate, the first Gate, maybe I feel. So I still have hope to reach, I keep the hope to reach the second gati, and of course all of us, all Buddhist practitioners, our final goal is the Bodhi that referred in the Heart Sutra, Bodhisvaha, that is the ultimate goal. So I should not turn away from this, what is difficult. So if you are somebody who don't want suffering for oneself and others and to wish happiness for oneself and others, one should cultivate this exchanging self and others. So for those bodhisattvas, for those who have the instinct of bodhicitta, who are of the duller faculty, this is something which is difficult. So it says that whoever wishes to quickly afford protection to both self and other beings should practice that holy sacred, the exchange of self and others. Because of attachment to one's body, my body, even a small object of fear frightens me. So we can reduce our preconceptions and fear and so forth by using our minds. But when you have a physical sickness like a headache, I mean, however much you think about having a good and healthy body and so forth, will not, this sickness will not go away. So who would not revile as an enemy this body that gives rise to fear? By wishing for a means to remedy the hunger, thirst, sickness of the body, I might kill birds, fish and deer, and loiter by the sides of roads to rob others. If for the sake of its profit and comfort I will kill even my father and mother and steal the property of Triple Gem, then I would undoubtedly proceed to burn in the flames of this deepest hell. Therefore, by what adept would desire, protect and venerate this body? So these healths, these are giving teachings on the attachments to this body. Although on the basis of this body we and this intelligence that we have, we can achieve huge goals of enlightenment and so forth, but there is lots of problems also that this body creates. So who would not scorn it and regard it as an enemy? Now, from 125 shows the actual practice of equaling and exchanging self and others. So, if I give this, what shall I have to enjoy? So, such selfish thinking is a way of ghosts. And if I enjoy this, what shall I have to left to give? Such selfish, selfless thinking is a quality of the gods. So if for my own sake I cause harm to others, I shall be tormented in hellish realms. So for the sake of my food, shelter, clothing, if I harm others, the result would be torment in hell. But if for the sake of others I cause my harm to myself, thinking of all sentient beings, infinite as the expanse of space, if you think I cause harm to myself, I shall acquire all that is magnificent. By holding myself in high esteem, having this arrogance, thinking I am somebody special and so forth, and not staying away from others, I shall find myself in unpleasant realms, ugly and stupid. So you'll be in the worst kind of serfdom. But should this attitude be shifted to others, by respecting others, by honoring others higher than yourself, I shall acquire, as the 8 verses of mind training says, may I hold others to be the highest, and may I hold myself lowest. So I shall acquire honors in a joyful realm, you will which means to take rebirth in a higher realm of existence. If I employ others for my own purposes, I myself shall experience servitude. So if you try to make others your servant, then the result is you experience the servitude. But if I use myself for the sake of others, so for the sake of others, if you could actually serve others with your body and your wealth and so forth, and also dedicate all the virtues that you have created for the benefit of other sentient beings, then it says, I shall experience only lordliness. So you should think that everything that you have are meant for other sentient beings to enjoy. As Master Nagarjuna makes this prayer, and also Master Shantideva makes this prayer, to be sustenance for all sentient beings until the end of space, as they desire. So if you use yourself for the sake of others, then you experience lordliness, where others will respect your words and you have authority and so forth. Whatever joy there is in this world, all comes from desiring others to be happy. So even in our empirical experience, we can see that if you are altruistic, then you are, and others are happy. So amongst the leaders, if there are people who think of the masses more than themselves, then everyone will be happy. Whereas people in authority and people who have wealth and knowledge, expertise, if they think about themselves alone, if they are selfish, then they would have to live in fear and anxiety. So whatever joy there is in this world will come from desiring others to be happy. And whatever suffering there is in this world all comes from desiring oneself to be happy. So this is like a huge summary that Master Shantideva is making. So even in a family, if everyone thinks of others more than themselves alone, then the family would be happier. On the other hand, if they think selfishly, then they will have suspicion about one another, and then there's anxiety and fear, and then there would be fighting. And so, whether we're talking about something small or big, whatever good there is comes from wishing others to be happy, and all the misfortunes come from wishing oneself to be happy. So what need is there to say much more? So the childish work for their own benefit, the childish like ourselves, and the Buddhas who think of others' well-being, work for the benefit of others. Just look at the difference between them. If I do not actually exchange my happiness for the suffering of others, I shall not attain the state of Buddhahood, and even in cyclic existence shall have no joy. If I cannot exchange self and others, happiness of oneself and suffering of others, you will not reach Buddhahood. Live alone reaching Buddhahood, even in samsara you will not be happy. So as I said earlier, a dog who always barks at others and fights with others will always remain alone. They'll be, and cats also. So whereas a friendly dog, a dog which is friendly with others, can sleep very cozily. So selfishness results in loneliness, let alone what is beyond this world. Because my servants do not work, and because my masters give me no pay, even the needs of this life will not be fulfilled. So in Japan, the companies are being successful in the past. This is because the workers in the companies have this, they consider the company to be their own family. But if the workers consider themselves, if the masters of the company, the owners of the company thing, have this attitude that their workers are like their servants, and the workers will not be so enthusiastic to work in the company. So by rejecting that the method that establishes both foreseeable and unforeseeable joy, I cast magnificent delight completely aside, and then, because of inflicting misery on others in confusion, I seize hold of unbearable pain. So whether the happiness that we can actually see in this life, or those which we do not have access yet. If all the injury, they come from thinking to benefit others, if all injury, fear and pain in this world arise from grasping itself, then what use is that great goes to me? So in history we have people who are considered very, very negative, evil. Of course, they were not evil right at birth, but because of circumstances and friends and their own way of thinking, they became people who thought only about their own selves. And then they bullied others, and therefore they have become evil people in history. Whereas others, like Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King, who thought about others' well-being. Although it's been many years since their death, people still feel joy when they hear their names. If I do not completely forsake it, I shall be unable to put an end to suffering, just as I cannot avoid being burned if I do not cast aside the fire I hold. Therefore, in order to allay these harms inflicted upon me, and in order to pacify the suffering of others, I shall give myself up to others and cherish them as I do my very self. I am under the control of others. Of this mind you must be certain. Now, except for benefiting every creature, you must not think of anything else. Now you should exhort yourself with these minds. So far we have given ourselves, trusted ourselves to the self-cherishing attitude, and we have been deceived by it. And therefore, I will go the other way around, and I will from now on cherish others more than myself. For my sake, I should not be doing anything. So in your mind, you should hold others to be dearer than yourself, cherish them more than yourself, and therefore you give yourself, consider yourself for others, at the service of others. So for myself, I should not do anything with these eyes and so forth, which I have left at the disposal of others. It is quite incorrect to do anything with them which is contrary to benefit others. Thus, sentient beings should be my main concern. Whatever I behold upon my body, I should rob and use for the benefit of others. And then from the 140, gives a special advice that comes in this text. Consider lesser beings and so forth as myself, and considering myself as the others. So from this verse down, few verses, what they show is you should consider the others to be higher and yourself to be lower. Sakya Pandita has said in his text called Thubha Gongsil, illuminating the intention of the Buddha. You have three different people. So those who are higher than you, they look down upon you. Those who are equal to you, they have competitive feeling. And then those who are lower than you are jealous of you. So this is one way of training your mind. Now, in the traditional explanations, you put the self, which is under the influence or of self-cherishing attitude, on one side. And then you imagine yourself, another self, on the other side, and look at this other one who is full of self-cherishing attitude as higher than yourself, and then have jealousy. So in these kind of visualizations, you have the practice of bringing up jealousy and looking upon yourself as inferior. And so consider lesser beings as so forth as myself, and consider myself as the other. And the following way I should meditate upon: envy, competitiveness, and self-importance, with a mind free from distorted concepts. So he is honored, I'm not found wealth. I have not found wealth as such as he. He is praised, but I am despised. He is happy, but I suffer. I have to do all the work while he remains comfortably at rest. He is renowned as great in this world, but I am as inferior, with no good qualities at all. But what do you mean? I have no good qualities. I have all good qualities. Compared to many, he is inferior, and compared to many, I am high. The deteriorated state of my morals and views is not due to me, but due to my disturbing conceptions. In whatever way he is able, he should heal me. Willingly, I shall accept any discomfort involved. But I'm not being healed by him, so why does he belittle me? What use are his good qualities to me? Although he has good qualities, he does not benefit me. With no compassion for the beings who dwell in the poisonous mouth of harmful realms, externally he is proud of his good qualities and wishes to put down the wise. And then verse number 174 shows viewing someone who is lower than yourself. In order that I may excel, he who is regarded as equal with me, I shall definitely strive to attain material gain and honor for myself, even by such means as verbal dispute. By all means, I shall make clear to the entire world. So verse number 174 shows visualizing someone equal to you and then having these thoughts and in training your mind. I once talked about this to Khunama Rinpoche, that these really helped. So when you train your mind in this way, what happens is on the one side yourself full of selfish attitude, and then on the other side the innumerable sentient beings. And when you compel them, your mind would run on to turn towards sentient beings, the limitless number of sentient beings. So it is said that this is deluded one. This deluded one is trying to compete with me. So here, deluded is not so much to talk about delusion, someone who is deluded as such, but someone who is very poor and impoverished. Is trying to compete with me, but how can he be equal with me in learning, intelligence, form, class, and all wealth? So you have these meditations whereby you visualize these three three types of beings, where yourself as being full of self-cherishing attitude, as being higher, equal, and lower. Because of desiring benefit yourself, O mind, all weariness you have gone through over countless past eons has only succeeded in achieving misery. Therefore, I should definitely engage myself in working for the benefit of others. For since the words of the Mighty One are infallible, I shall behold its advantages in the future. So if you could train your mind to cherish others more than yourself and reduce the self-cherishing attitude, and through this training, if you could at least have some experience of having reduced the self-cherishing attitude and cherishing others more than yourself, then you will have happiness. In the past, I have practiced this act of exchanging self and others. A situation such as this, devoid of magnificence and bliss of the Buddha, could not possibly have come about. Therefore, just as I have come to hold as I these drops of sperm and blood of others, likewise through acquaintance, I should also come to regard all others. Having thoroughly examined myself to see whether I am really working for others or not, I should steal whatever appears on my body and use it for the benefit of others. So I'm happy, but others are sad. I'm high, though others are low. I benefit myself, but not others. Why am I not envious of myself? So 161, I must separate myself from happiness and say, take upon myself the suffering of others. Why am I doing this now? In this way, I should examine myself, examine myself for faults. Although others may do something wrong, I should transform it into fault of my own. But should I do something even slightly wrong, I shall openly admit it to many people. By further describing the renown of others, I should make it outshine my own. So this shows that you will not let yourself be under the sway of the self-cherishing attitude, but cherishing others. So far, the self-cherishing attitude has been dealt with rather gently. From verse 168, it is being dealt with rather harshly. However, mind, although you have been advised, if you do not act in a like manner, then since all misfortunes will entrust themselves to you, you will only be destined to destruction. So that previous time when you could overcome me is now past. Now I see your nature and your faults, and wherever you go, I shall destroy your arrogance. So I should immediately cast aside all thoughts of working for my own sake. By having sold you to others, I shall not become discouraged, but shall offer all your strength to others. So these are talking about seeing the faults of self-cherishing attitude and the advantage of cherishing others. If, having become unconscientious, I do not give you to all living beings, it is certain that you will deliver me to the guardians of the hells. For ages have you dealt with me like this, and I have suffered long. But now, recalling all my grudges, I shall overcome you selfish thoughts. Likewise, if I wish to be happy, I should be happy with myself. And similarly, if I wish to be protected, I should constantly protect all others. To what degree I take great care of this body, to that degree I shall fall into a state of extreme helplessness. So this 74 down also shows some fault of this body. Having fallen in this way, if my desires are unable to be fulfilled, even by everything upon this earth, what else will be able to satisfy them? Being unable to fulfill them, though desiring to do so, disturbing conceptions and dissatisfied mind will ensue. However, if I do not depend on any material things, the exhaustion of my good fortune will be unknown. Therefore, I shall never create an opportunity for the desires of the body to increase, for whatever I do not grasp at attractive, these are the best of all possessions. In the end, my body will turn to dust, unable to move by itself. It will be repelled by others. Why do I grasp this unbearable and clean form as I? Whether it lives or whether it dies, what use is this machine to me? How is it different from the clots of earth? Oh, why do I not dispel this pride? Having accumulated suffering for no purpose because of my honoring and serving this body, what use is the attaching and anger to for this thing? This is similar to a piece of wood. So earlier, In the text, there's mention of using this human body. You should journey or voyage across the ocean of suffering. So far, I have you have it is saying this text is saying that you have given yourself into self-cherishing attitude, and now you have seen all the faults, and you are saying goodbye to it. It says, so enough of this childish behavior, I shall follow in steps of the wise, in verse 185. And having recalled the advice concerning consciousness, I shall turn away sleep and mental dullness. Just like the compassionate children of the conqueror, I shall patiently accept what I have to do. For if I do not make constant effort day and night, when will my misery ever come to an end? Therefore, in order to dispel the obscurations, I shall withdraw my mind from the mistaken ways and constantly place it in compassion upon the perfect object. So this text is like a king of different treatises, amongst treatises, explaining the cultivation of bodhicitta. So chapter 9, I'll read through some verses. All the 84,000 teachings of the Buddha are meant for cultivating and developing this wisdom, which is able to do critical analysis into the reality. So omniscient mind of body is what we are aiming at. So our ultimate goal is to attain omniscient state of mind wherein you are able to see everything as it is and all the varieties as well as the ultimate reality of things simultaneously. So it says all of these practices, branch of teachings by the mighty one taught them for the sake of wisdom. Therefore, those who wish to specify suffering should generate this wisdom. So when we talk about selflessness, they're saying that nothing exists inherently. To someone who has no idea about selflessness, what it means, they would say, if you tell them that nothing has any objective inherent existence, they would be rather surprised and say, what are you saying? So we should know that there is an appearance and a reality. So we should not leave only at the appearance level, but we should see the reality, just as the scientists also do. They are not satisfied with what appears, but they do all kinds of investigation to see the reality. And so in quantum physics, they come to understand that there is nothing objectively existing. And therefore, we should not be satisfied only with the appearance of things, but how things actually are. And so, because of this absolutizing, we become attached or averse. We have aversion to others. And therefore, we need to establish that there is something beyond this appearance, that there is a reality. And therefore, there is teaching on the two truths. So ultimate and the conventional are said to be the two truths. So the differentiation between the two truths is because we are lost in what appears to us and are not able to see the reality, therefore we get confused. And so with regard to the two truths, the Heart Sutra also says, form is empty, emptiness is form, form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than form. So in all the religious philosophical traditions, non-Buddhist and Buddhist philosophical schools, they talk about the two truths. So form is empty, emptiness is form, shows that the conventional and ultimate realities are of the same nature. So they should be distinguished conceptually. So everything has these two truths, conventional and ultimate reality. And one is established merely without doing any analysis into them, but then the other is established by checking the reality, how things exist. And so even the scientists do investigate the reality, and therefore they come to... because things do not exist the way they appear, therefore we can make change in them. Therefore the scientists are able to make changes in things. And so we need to... we should not believe in the appearances, and therefore see what appears to us is not the reality as such, and therefore do away with distorted views. Of course, everything that appears to us is not false as such. This is not to say. So what we need is to oppose those distorted ways of existence. So those things which are truth and reality, they have the support of valid knowledge and valid cognition. And in the Brahmanavartika, there is also mention of how we achieve, we attain the fruits, which have the support of valid knowledge. And these fruits are they are direct and indirect fruits of the valid cognition, and therefore we need to develop this wisdom realizing emptiness, seeing that it is a valid cognition, that it sees realities and it is able to cut through the false appearances and do away with all our shortcomings and faults. So tomorrow we'll first do the upasaka vow, layperson's vows, and then we'll do the generation of bodhicitta. Bring your text, Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, tomorrow. We'll do the seven limb practice, from second chapter, and then into the third chapter. And after that, we'll have... to create a tantric connection in terms of tantra. I'll do the Chandrasik blessing of Chandrasik Nyaswan Kundul and Tara and Ekajati. I'll do a Jenang of these. So that's all.